All right. Got to get our puns in order. And Mr. Dobbs might be appreciative of puns since certainly Marshall McLuhan was. Bob Dobbs is, well, he's very next to impossible to introduce, which is to his credit, a McLuhan scholar, a paramedia ecologist. These are merely hints at the unique penetrating perceptions Bob has brought to modern culture. And he joins us from the New York City environs. Bob, good morning.
Good morning, Doug. Yes, I'm a walking pun.
I've heard that about you.
Yep.
You know, back in the mid to late 60s, Bob, one of the most popular shows on television was Laugh-In. I loved it. And one of the regulars, Henry Gibson, would on occasion come in front of the camera holding a flower, and he would stare into the camera and say, "Marshall McLuhan, what are you doing?" And it's pretty good when a scholar gets mentioned on a comedy show on a regular basis. Since Henry Gibson isn't here, let's ask you, who was Marshall McLuhan and what was he doing?
Okay. We know and assume that Einstein probably was, Albert Einstein, was probably the most influential thinker of the first half of the 20th century. Would we agree on that?
I would agree on it.
Yes.
And had one of the most best perceptive quotes I've ever heard.
What I just said, you mean?
Well, no, my favorite Einstein quote is his definition of insanity is to keep doing what you've been doing and expect different results.
Yeah. Okay. So we assume that he led to technologies that had devastating effects. Well, I say, and knowledgeable people, there's a few of us around in the McLuhan world, would say that Marshall McLuhan is the most influential person of the second half of the 20th century. And he was a new kind of scientist on the level of Einstein because we'd moved into a world of rapid technological change in the, say, 1850 up to 1950. But what was unique about the second half of the 20th century is that it was more important to study the effects of this technological change rather than just sort of naively hoping for progress and beneficent effects or products to be perpetually dumped on us. It was the disservices of technologies that were rapidly becoming apparent, especially after the atomic bomb. So we needed a new strategy, and McLuhan discovered that. And he built on the discoveries of Wyndham Lewis, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, W.B. Yeats, and especially James Joyce. And the way he brought that together is significant and still not fully appreciated. But when the wall went down in 1989, the Berlin Wall, it was then that people started to see, oh, this is something unforeseen. And yet McLuhan had predicted that in 1970 in his Doolittle newsletter.
He was an amazing guy. And you know, one of my favorite sources or favorite experiences reading McLuhan, as much as I enjoyed his books, was an interview, which I think is still available on the web, back in the 60s in Playboy magazine, of all places. But that was the great thing about McLuhan. He was a literary scholar, but he said, if we want to teach our kids in the 60s and obviously on, we have to understand the effects of new media on our minds, because these media are creating entire environments. And if we don't understand them, we can't understand each other. So is this what we call media ecology?
Yes, but let me fill something in here. It's it was the bias of say the 19th century to think that the book was the highbrow medium and any other communication media were pop culture, vulgar, and not capable of imparting insights or pattern recognition. And it was the insights of Joyce, Eliot, Pound, Lewis, and the Dadaists and the Surrealists and the people at the turn of the into the 20th century started incorporating other technologies, other media into their paintings, their books, their plays. And it was the insight that the medium is a message which was percolating back then, 100 years ago. But it was McLuhan who, as he said, applied those guys and their insights. And then when you come to the Playboy interview, the interviewer, Eric Norden, he interviewed McLuhan several times and couldn't, and he transcribed it, and he couldn't understand McLuhan. So what happened is that McLuhan then wrote out the answers to those questions in the Playboy article, which is an amazing interview because it looks like a machine said it because they're long answers in detail, and you can't imagine someone saying that. But that's the reason. He could say it, but it's even more extreme because he ended up writing the interview answers because Norden couldn't understand him.
Well, you know, I think like a great Zen master, and I know Marsha was a devout Catholic, right? But he, to me, he was really using the process of a Zen master, because he, on a certain level, it seemed, almost enjoyed confusing people a little bit.
Well, yes, his faith in the Roman Catholicism was, he grew up as a Baptist, I think, and he said in his household there was lots of, or in his community in those days, there were conflicts between Baptists and Catholics, and it was considered an act of rebellion by him converting to Catholicism. But he later discovered with studies of Joyce and then Eric Havelock and Walter Ong that the Catholic faith was built on the phonetic alphabet. And he understood that the foundations of the Catholic faith would not stand up to the electronic onslaught. He used to have a phrase for the present world called the prince of the air, or an electric engineer, master of hardware and software. You know, some people call that the Antichrist. But he knew and had the detachment that the Catholic faith had to deal with a new situation, and that made him detached about all religions which were built on the manuscript medium. And he was interested through Ted Carter, his associate, of studying shamanism and anthropology, that he was quite sophisticated in his studying the patterns of the mind. And I wouldn't hesitate, it's sort of hidden, to say that he was devising a new theological response to the problems of being a Catholic. So, yes, he would look at other religions, and he called himself a Menippean satirist. Menippus was a writer about 220 B.C. who was outrageous because he would mix prose and poetry. So he was one of the first mixed-media artists in the written world, in what we would call the pre-Gutenberg situation. And Menippean satire updated via Finnegan's Wake and other poems like Pound's Cantos, the mixing of media, that sensibility was the only way one could create what McLuhan calls being anti-environmental, looking at one situation through another. So he used his Catholic faith and other cultures as an anti-environment, but he was flexible. And that very mode of being flexible was unique and maybe would be considered heretical by the average Catholic. I'm not sure. But many Catholics knew him in Toronto said he wasn't your normal Catholic.
No, he wasn't. And, as a result, I mean, he had an amazing run, and his influence is so pervasive. I mean, let's just talk about Madison Avenue. I mean, it was McLuhan who I remember was first saying, if we really want to understand, this is back in the 60s, if we want to understand what the Cultural Revolution is all about, we have to study advertising. Not too many people were saying that. Give us an example of how he might take an ad and get from it what was going on underneath the culture.
Okay, just a bit of background. He'd studied George Meredith at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg in the 30s. Then he went to Cambridge, and he retook his BA and MA under British conditions. He already had his MA and BA in Canadian terms. But it was there he got the shock of his life when he studied I.A. Richards and Mr. Leavis. They were looking at Joyce and Eliot in the beginning, and Lewis had just put a book out in 1932 called Doom of Youth, where he studied the effect of advertising on youth. So McLuhan was looking at all this pop culture and having a 19th century bias from his Canadian education. He thought this was strange, but that's what he learned. So then he came to Madison, Wisconsin in 36, 37, and he found he couldn't communicate to the kids, so he started looking at their culture. So we're talking about him studying advertising in the 60s. He started in the late 30s and developed a slideshow in the middle 40s, and then Mechanical Bride was sitting there for 6 years at Vanguard Press here in New York until it got published in 51, and he was even quite unsatisfied with what the final production was because they found certain things outrageous and vulgar and they wouldn't put in. And advertising agencies threatened to sue them. So there's a whole controversy around this. Now, advertising, he then felt, was superseded by the forms of the media, not the content. But the basic method of looking at an ad was what he called figure ground. You look at the content, and then the ground is what the audience is, what it's targeted against, what the audience is, the demographics, and taking Aristotle's four causalities, one of them is formal causality, and McLuhan said that we lost the ability of say, in the 18th, 19th century to look at pharmacocausality or the effects. And I'm coming to your answer of media quality, then the way you look at ads. We didn't look at the effects of media, which was pharmacocausality, looking at the effects on the audience. So the ground is the audience. The figure is the new medium. So you take an ad, and he did two books on this, The Mechanical Bride and Cultured Our Business, and you would look at the images, how they were identified by the audience, sort of like primitive identification, and while they looked at the content of the ad, the real effects of the ad went to work on the person's mind and senses. So he used the aphorism, advertising is the red piece of meat left out by the burglar to distract the watchdog of the mind. Now, we could take, what's an ad? Think of an ad. I don't watch TV. I don't know much about ads. But take a cliche ad. What's an example? Give me one, then we'll look at
it. Well, I meant from the 60s, the Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz.
Oh, okay. Now, because Americans were visually biased, eye-oriented culture, the sound effects, and McLuhan wrote about this in Mechanical Bride, he would write out the sound effects, the movement of the camera, and all the multi-sensory modes was where the real seduction happened. So because people were literate in the 19th and early 20th century, hyper-literate, they missed the modalities working on the other senses. So the plop, plop, plop is an example of using John Cage or Stockhausen techniques in advertising.
And again, it was average. You know, if we want to look at two of the industries that took McLuhan very seriously and still do to this day, it's Madison Avenue and the military, and they seem to be doing quite well.
Yes, let me tell you something that's not known. McLuhan eventually sort of gathered together all his work and all the different phases he had created and studied, and created the tetrad, which was a four-part process you use to analyze the dynamics of any technology. You would look at what the technology enhanced, what sensory faculties or interior faculties of our bodies enhanced, what previous technology had obsolesced, what older technology that had been obsolesced, so obsolesced as sitting invisible over on the side, what aspects of that resonated with the new technology that was retrieved, and then when you use the technology too much, what characteristics, opposite characteristics it flipped into. Now, politically, the CIA and DIA and intelligence agencies had developed the tetrad instinctively in the late 70s and early 80s, and when George Gorbachev met with Bush in 1989 after the wall went down, he asked for formulas on how to deal with the breaking up of the Soviet Empire, which he still was hoping to control in some way, and he knew of this sort of tetradic formula, and that's what he got from Bush in, I guess it would be December 89, when they first met, and they called them sociological algorithms. But the man in Baltimore who invented the sociological algorithms, when McLuhan's book, The Laws of Media with the Tetrad, came out in 87, 88, he said, that's what I'm looking for, and he kind of refined it because he was just groping with it. But that's an example of how McLuhan had effects way beyond what just Madison Avenue. But I take that as something for you to consider, is that politics eventually had to use the tetrad in understanding how, look at what happened in the Soviet Union. As it cracked up, Lithuania and these countries wanted to retrieve national identity, and even though they're moving into a globalized environment, they could not see that. So they interpreted the globalized effect of the going down the Berlin Wall as something retrieved from the past. But it was going to flip into something worse, which was economic chaos, which we witnessed in the early 90s. You follow what I'm saying here?
Yeah, we're talking with Bob Dobbs, and he's a McLuhan scholar, paramedia ecologist. Let me throw out, the way I like to play with McLuhan is, let me throw out some of his probes and get your comment on them and how you might even update them as we sit here in 2006.
Let me predict how it update. But my when you call me paramedia ecology, what I mean by that is media ecology was using the tetrad. It was, on a pop culture level, looking at television and its contents and figuring out the figure ground. But media ecology on the vast level was, as he said in the Playboy interview, if you have too much social turmoil going on in Venezuela, you would turn off the radio and give them some newspapers or a television environment for 6 weeks to create a different mood. He would say television would cool down the population, whereas newspapers would heat up the population and radio even more. You look at Latin America in the 70s, you had nothing but death squads all over Central America and Latin America due to the hyper-radio environment, just like in Europe. You, when radio came in the 20s, 30s, you end up having World War II. So that's a big way of looking at it. Now, I say today, with the digital environment, which is really technology take on a life of its own, because it replays all the technologies we've extended from speech to the bulldozer to the satellite, and replays it on its own dynamic, shrinks it, and makes the situation with no divisions between any technology. If you look at understanding media, you got a chapter on radio, chapter on TV, chapter on movies. Nowadays, a five-year-old kid has a Palm Pilot, and he or she has all those massive environments shrunk down and in one seamless web on their Palm Pilot. So there's no division in media, and that's why I use the phrase paramedia. There's only one medium, and that medium is the image of the White House. George Bush is an untranslatable medium because we can't translate any medium into another medium. That's the general role of metaphor. We can't metaphorize our situation, so we interpret the Bush administration as unilateral. Can't be translated. That has all kinds of disservices. So, with that in mind, give me some probes.
Okay. A point of view can be a dangerous luxury when substituted for insight and understanding.
That's a good one. I have a chart here of all these McLuhan aphorisms, and that's on there. Now, point of view means visual space, and how do we have understanding today? The problem is how I would update that with paramedia is that media itself would say that to other media. George Bush is saying to the New York Times, you people have a point of view. That's the nature of your medium. The problem is you can't have a point of view under our situation, our imploded media situation, so we're just using and making a pattern, and we call it unilateralism. That's how I'd update that.
Advertising is the greatest art form of the 20th century.
I would update by saying not communicating is the great art form of the 21st century.
Well, Bush is a master at that.
That's exactly what it is. He does not communicate because people live and are sick of the overwhelming media they put up with over the last 40 years. And now you have charisma, which McLuhan defined as looking like a lot of other people. The charisma for the average, which may be called the red states, whereas the blue states are on the coast, the people who make a living out of the media, L.A. and New York and that, and then the effects of all that media wrecks the red states' lives and their careers and their village, their towns and employment opportunities because everything is outsourced into a digitalized global environment. So for the red states, they prefer someone to stick it to the media. And Bush's charisma is, I don't read the newspaper, I don't watch TV, I ain't communicating to you guys. So it's a different situation now.
McLuhan said, only puny secrets need protection. Big discoveries are protected by public incredulity.
Oh, that's a great one. Now, you know the Internet has fostered a lot of conspiracy theory, supposedly, right? You've heard that cliche, there's nothing but conspiracy theories on the Internet. Well, that phrase, which I put out 15 years ago in a conspiracy group, they use that everywhere. They love that. And that is an effect of media, of the Internet, of the paramedia seamless web, is that people now look at the form. They actually are McLuhanites and aren't aware of it. And because it's you versus the seamless web, it looks like you're being conspired against. But the real situation today is that aphorism relates to media content. And so the big secrets are protected by public incredulity. I would suggest that what I'm talking about, the effects of media, is what's protected today by public incredulity, including the audience and users of the Internet. They wouldn't understand that the Internet is not talking to them. The big insight today is to realize media are not talking to you. The media is talking to itself.
So where does that leave us?
It leaves us on the sidelines. But at the same time, we have a superiority complex. The services that, and the kids grow up with this, they don't take in any information. They're like Bush because the massive environment of radio in the 30s leads to World War II. Now, radio is not a separate environment under Internet conditions. It is just one little button up in the corner of your screen, all those hundreds of radio stations, including the people who are listening to us right now on the Internet. So the major media environments, incredulous as it sounds, do not have the effect on us, and therefore kids are growing up superior to media environments, not intimidated. And this explains a lot of their attitude if we actually did an inventory of them, but I won't go into it now, but that's my main point there. We are superior to information now, and therefore, and at the same time, a kid can edit anything they want. So we've got producer mania, I call it, not consuming mania. We've got people creating their own information sites, and once we have voice recognition, you're going to have millions of people on there broadcasting and mouthing off. Now, if you were White House, if you're president at that point, what are you going to do? You're going to ignore information. Because how can you coordinate a billion people? We actually, people talk about the fascism that Bush is bringing in. That's only fascism in terms of the old medium freedom of speech. But we have incredible democratic forms of expression now that you can't measure the conditions of our environment in terms of fascism, democratic, or whatever.
Now, if we go back to the medium is the message, if I read it correctly...
The medium is it's a four-line poem. The medium is the message, the medium is the massage, the medium is the mess age, and the medium is the mass age. That's the four-line poem that McLuhan created in 1968 from that phrase.
All right, if we're to just grab onto it for a second and swim in it for a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Then what I'm hearing is it doesn't matter on a certain level, correct me if I'm wrong, whether George Bush is president or someone else is president. The reason Bush is president is because the technology unconsciously creates an environment where people want their leader not to be not to inform them.
That's the present demand now. Let's just run through the images. We can say the idea of a virtual society. With the National Security Act of 1947, the president and his advisors, by law, were allowed to lie to the American people. That's because the national entity after World War II was obsolete. You lived in a globalized situation from 1947 on. So you had to explain, you had to be able to lie in terms of national demographics what you were doing collectively. I mean, many scholars have found out that the KGB and the CIA knew each other's station chiefs and all that since the 50s. So that level of Cold War division and information paranoia was obsolete. So who is the presidential image in the 50s? Because McLuhan had the phrase, the word makes the market. In an imploded media environment, especially after the satellite environment of the Sputnik 57 on, you have an imploded information environment, which is still talking to the people. We haven't got to the point where the media are talking to themselves and not to humans. But so you have the bland Ike image, which is a guy who had to sort of frozen under the new national security laws, kind of awkward. He can't tell people the truth, so he's caught later lying about you too. Then you have the Kennedy image, which is Tom Sawyer in the White House. This is the last gasp of the northern situation. But television was bringing in a southern sensibility with rock and blues. So eventually you're going to start having southern presidents, which is Nixon, or LBJ, then Nixon, then Carter. Now, Carter was the peanut farmer. Now, we're into the 70s. Satellite computers and mixed media and cable TV is starting to really dissolve the national image. But still, the recycling for newspaper people, you need to have the White House. So Carter comes in as a southern peanut farmer. Then you have the shock when you move into the 80s and the virtual reality. I'm using that cliche term, which means mixed corporate media starting to take on a life of its own. You have an actor as a president. That was shocking. You know what I mean? The point is each phase reflect the media dynamics that we're building up. So then after Reagan, what do you have? You have a CIA director. Now, that's interesting. That's right at the end of the Cold War. You have information becoming obsolete. And therefore, the last gasp of that is a CIA director. So was Gorbachev. An intel KGB person. But then, in the 90s, when you have the internet and the slippery Android meme information environment or paramedia ecology, Android meme is my phrase, where just the idea that there is some communication going on is a fake and gone and taken on a life of its own, in that situation where technology is not talking to people, you have an image of a president known as Slick Willie, which is different from Reagan, who was just presenting a fake. It's called a fake, but it's actually reality.
He was acting. He was acting as president.
He was acting as president. But then information is disappearing, so you have a different kind of presidential image, Bush, but you're leading to the post-information environment where a guy is known for being a slick liar. You know what I mean?
So
that's Clinton. So then you're going to flip that environment following the tetrad when you move into 2000, when the information Y2K explosion didn't happen because the Android meme wasn't talking to people, so there wasn't wasn't going to be a Y2K situation. And in the shock of a post-information environment, completely post, where the information is not talking to you, you have a new presidential image, and it has charisma and responds to people's subconscious, as you mentioned. So you have a guy like George Bush who can't finish his sentence, can't speak, it's not communicating.
It's scary. Now, but where is this leading? Can you, based on the tetrad, based on being a paramedia ecologist, which basically means you're studying the effects of media on how we think, on how we feel, on how we act.
And on other media.
Based on that study, can you make a prediction as to what type of president comes next?
I say no president comes next. We ain't going to have an election. You already started to have that with the managed election of 2000 and the so-called rigged election of 2004. These are expressions of the idea that we're post-election. It's post-communication time. We don't need an American White House. And that's what I predicted in the year 2000. I said there's going to be some problem where we're not going to have an election in 2000. Now, we had one, but it got canceled and aborted, and the population's been in agony ever since, especially the blue states. And the sophisticated information-generating, information-producing jobs, they've been total anxiety about this image. So I think that we're on the edge of a nuclear war or something. And I don't know if it'll be a nuclear war, but we're right now what's going on in Israel is an expression of an expansion without any rules. Nobody can stop it. They aren't going to stop. Nobody knows why it's happening, but they know it's just Paleolithic. So we have retrieved the Paleolithic sensibility. That's what 2001 was. One guy in a cave going after another guy in a cave. It was a personal battle between the Bush and bin Laden, right?
Right.
And then the Iraqi war was between Bush and Saddam, two cavemen. So the cavemen are now out in the field, the media field, which is not communicating to humans, and it's going to escalate. So I don't know if a presidential image is probable. But let's say we survive that tension over the next 2 years, then maybe we will flip into a female president. The first female president.
And why? What is it about your study of the media environment that tends to make you think it would be a female president?
Because we've had men, and it's been patriarchal. The newspaper world, the Gutenberg world before the electronic Marconi world of the 18th, 19th century, heightened up, as McLuhan said, the left hemisphere. And men are more naturally left hemisphere than women. So that's why under the phonetic alphabet over the last 2,000 years, then the printing press, and then the newspaper environment, we have had more and more, quote, patriarchal leadership. So the White House was brought in by a bunch of white men. So to cancel that legacy, that meme, we would have to have a woman as a president.
Hear, hear. Now, one last thing. We only have a minute here, but Bob, you can think fast. You point out a lot of the kind of negative, scary potential scenarios, but you know what? In human cultural history, every renaissance is preceded by a dark age. So if we can transcend and get through the dark ages, we can come to a renaissance. At the same time that all these emotions and passions are heightening and information is becoming obsolete, as you say, there's another force that McLuhan pointed out and I know he changed it from the global village to the global theater, but the fact is that we are all connected much more intimately to each other. And to me, that's a very positive transformation, or at least could be a potentially very positive transformation, because, and I think one of the most influential events of the 20th century, and very few people pay attention to it, was the first published photograph of the Earth in its entirety, satellite photo, because we got to see our home in complete home for the first time. That led to an environmental movement. So can there not be some positive effects from some of this electronic connection that's going on around the world?
Yes, the 20th century has been largely a world of software, information environment. So what would we flip into? Hardware, but it would be a new hardware. And the good news is, and I've laid this out for 15 years, the good news is that cold fusion, a device that Pons and Fleischmann came up with, which creates more energy for powering heat and the basic shelter, more energy comes out than goes in. That phenomenon known as cold fusion, other people now call it zero-point energy, we are going to have that through China, because the Middle East is going to get bogged down in the mess that's unfolding the next few years. Saudi Arabia won't be able to get its oil out. The one country that's living in the 19th century is China, and it's expanding. The only one really expanding industrially this decade, it will need the oil. And it will be so motivated. It's a different kind of sensibility. Talk about people being tribal and feeling connected. The Chinese people will want to protect their 5,000 or more year old culture. They want to preserve their national identity. They're not going to play around with oil company games. They're going to look into alternative energy. about 9 different kinds are going to be offered to them. They will pick Pons and Fleischmann, and humanity will finally have a new energy system by the early, 2010, 2012, and that is the breakthrough. We're flipping from software, services, and disserv to an incredible new kind of hardware service. That's the good news.
Well, I'll tell you what, we've only touched the surface, so we'll have to do it again, and I'm sure there are people sitting there going, what just happened? And we like that, because that's what the Zen Master does. Throw a few banana peels in front of you, and then we get out of our normal patterns of thinking. Bob Dobbs, give us some URLs. Give us some ways that we can tap into your brain virtually.
You can go to 5bodied, that's BODIED, 5bodied.com/project. That's where my articles and interviews and repository is. Or you can go to 5bodied.com and join in on the chat line, which has been going on for a couple of years now.
And you can always Google Bob Dobbs, which is a lot of fun to do. And we appreciate, the conversation. Let's do it some more, because there's nothing more fun than enlightening and confusing people at the same time.
Yes, being an inaudible environment, yet quite loud.
Bob, it was a pleasure. Let's do it again.
Okay, Doug, great talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Okay, bye.
We're going to take our final break, and then we'll come back and wrap this sucker up.